Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Bodcast, Bustle's podcast for radical body positivity, fat acceptance, and visibility for all. I'm Marie Southard Ospina, and I'm pretty stoked to be joined by novelist Saray Walker, author of Dietland, which was released in summer 2015. And for those of you who haven't read it, the novel does a really wonderful job at dissecting the intricacies of being fat, and particularly of being a fat woman, while simultaneously tackling everything from rape culture to sexism in the media to self-harm to the way beauty standards affect us all, really. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about all of that, as well as some reactions Saray has received for her novel, and just the realities of living in a culture that promotes quote-unquote ideal beauty. So thank you so much for joining me, Saray.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. And in case there are some listeners who aren't familiar with your work, was there anything you'd like to add about what you're doing?
Well, Dietland actually is out in paperback next week in the USA and Canada. So it'll be, you know, in a cheaper format starting next week, so that's always good.
Oh, that's great. What I really love about it, and protagonist Plum, is just how universally relatable some of the experiences she has or that she's recollecting are, likely for the majority of folks who grow up fat, and especially in Western cultures. Everything from the incessant calorie counting to the fear of letting doctors see one unclothed, particularly at the gynecologist. I feel like I had the same experience she had. You know, telling yourself that things like love and sex just aren't for you, yo-yo dieting, weight loss programs, assigning morality to food, the thin person within, just all of these things. And I'm wondering if you had a pretty good idea in mind of how you thought both fat readers and thin readers would respond to all those moments.
But I knew that different groups of people would read the novel in different ways. And I do think there are people who just read it as a page turner. And there are people that just read it on that level.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about when I was writing it, you know, what would a fat person, a fat reader think? And so I wanted to write something that I knew, you know, I feel like literature doesn't really deal with fatness in a very serious way very often. You know, we all talk about fat all the time. It's in the media, obesity epidemic, and all of these things. But in literature, and even film and television, the experience of what it's actually like to be fat isn't really explored very much.
No, all the feelings that come with it.
Yeah, exactly. It's always fat people as, you know, the objects of ridicule.
Yes.
And, you know, just these objects of fun. So I wanted to try, you know, it was a daunting task, but I wanted to try and write a novel that explores, you know, what it's like to be fat. And I know there are, you know, many experiences of what it's like to be fat, and there's no single, you know, fat woman's experience. But I thought that there would at least be parts of it that probably most fat people could relate to. And so I thought it was important that fat people, particularly fat women, could see themselves represented in literature and art, because I don't think that, you know, again, there's much of that out there. And so that's one of the things that I was aware of as I was writing.
To find a protagonist who isn't automatically just the point is to ridicule said protagonists, and it's, you know, it's a character we see become empowered. I think that's very rare in literature in general still for fat characters.
Like to have fat positive literature. You know, when I was contacting people last year before the book came out, people involved in fat activism, and I said, you know, this is a fat positive book, and I know a lot of them were like, yeah, right. You know, we've been down this road before.
Yeah.
So I really had to work hard to convince people, no, I promise this is something different. Because, you know, people are justifiably cynical about it.
Yes, and I think when it comes to the mainstream representation we're now seeing for a lot of plus size and fat positive related coverage, it is watered down to a degree. And I think it's easy to be skeptical of the motives and who is this actually catering to. So it makes sense. And what about, you know, there's so many moments that are very hard-hitting in the book, where we see just how severely notions of beauty standards and of, you know, thin being the ideal are affecting Plum and affecting those around her. But did you have any kind of idea of how you thought thin readers would react to all of these things, including moments where, you know, you kind of see how people use the word fat even around people who are fat in a negative way without realizing it? You know, did you hope thin readers would kind of have more awareness of these things and of the ways so many people fat shame sometimes unknowingly?
Yeah, I think there have been a couple different reactions from thin readers, a few different. I've had some readers who are thin who have said they could relate to everything in Plum's life, which I thought was really interesting.
It is really interesting.
You know, and I mean, obviously it's, you know, every woman in this culture, you know, has her body critiqued and attacked and never feels good enough. But I thought it was interesting that someone who's been thin their whole life could feel like they could relate to Plum. So, you know, that's been an interesting response. I had one woman who's been very thin her entire life who said, you know, until I read Dietland, I really didn't understand maybe what it would be like to be fat. You know, I just really couldn't imagine it. And this was the first time that I'd maybe been inside the shoes of a fat person and could maybe experience that a little bit. But then I've had thin women who want to sort of argue with me. So, for example, the scene or the chapter where Plum goes on the blind dates, right?
Yes.
And she goes on a series of blind dates, and the men don't know that she's fat.
Yep. And they don't react well.
Yes, they don't react well. And I've had several thin women say, oh, well, that would never happen. Yeah, these guys wouldn't go to her door and be so rude to her or treat her that way.
Wow.
And, okay. But every fat woman I talk to is like, oh, that would definitely happen. Or maybe it's happened to them. So I think that there might be some defensiveness in some way in some thin readers, perhaps, thinking, you know, not understanding what it is like to be fat and how particularly men react to you very differently if you're fat than if you're thin.
Most people can agree that fat is socially undesirable. But then why wouldn't logic follow that that would mean fat people would be treated very differently?
Right. It's like, why are they afraid of becoming fat then?
Yeah, if you don't, you know, things would be fat. Yeah, just.
I think it's the idea of not wanting to acknowledge perhaps that people that treat you as a thin person a positive way for being thin, that they would treat a fat person, the same person might treat a fat person very differently. And I think that does make people uncomfortable. And they don't like to acknowledge it.
Yeah, I wonder if there's, you know, a layer of recognizing our privileges makes us uncomfortable sometimes, you know, to kind of admit to oneself that even if you go through a lot of these body image insecurities, there's a level to marginalization. And, you know, if you're fat, you're very likely going to be subject to more marginalization than if you're thin. And if you're a fat woman of color, you're probably going to be subject to more marginalization than a fat white woman. And I think people are quite frightened sometimes of even acknowledging those things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just being confronted with that and not wanting to think about the ways that, you know, a particular person is privileged in their everyday life.
Yeah, I know that you mentioned you did part of your PhD research on the construction of normative femininity of the body, which I find fascinating. It's kind of like a loaded little term, construction of normative femininity of the body. But what does that mean to you?
When I first started thinking about fatness, fat in a critical way, one of the questions I was thinking about was, why are fat women so hated? Because that's not an easy question to answer. There isn't one simple answer to it. But, you know, if we look throughout time, for example, we look at the 20th century, you can see that the idealized body shape shifts and changes over time. Even though now we've been in a period since, I would say, the mid 60s, where it's just been thin, 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 and it gets worse.
The era of Twiggy.
Yeah, exactly. It hasn't stopped.
No.
But I think that, you know, at any given time, there's a particular type of female body that's the idealized type of body. And I think that, you know, it's whoever doesn't fit into that can face a lot of abuse and marginalization. And so I think that I've just been in my academic work, I was looking at, you know, what it means to have this idealized feminine body. And there's a lot more that goes into it just besides thin and fat. You know, it's being thin, it's being young, right? So all these kind of anti-aging.
Having fair skin.
Yeah, exactly. And having, not just being thin, right, but having still a little bit of curves or large breasts.
Yes, curves in the right places.
Yeah, exactly. And even how you move, you know, how women are more constricted in how we move than men. But, you know, man spreading has been something yes. that's been focused on a lot. And so I was reading Sandra Lee Bartke, who is a feminist philosopher and theorist, who has written a lot about this. It's very complex, but just to sort of give you a little bit of a thumbnail version, she writes about how obtaining the normative feminine body is this process of discipline and punishment, right? So you're constantly having to discipline your body in these punishing regimes to try and get it to conform to the ideal, which I think is pretty much impossible, even for women who are these gorgeous models, right? They'll eventually age out, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, even for people that adhere to it closely are never going to forever. So she writes about it as this process of discipline and punishment. And that really influenced me in Dietland and thinking about dieting as this form of disciplining and punishing your body and trying to get it to conform into this ideal shape. And how hard that is, because your body will fight you every step of the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the construction of the feminine body and the ideal body.
I think about this particularly at this time of year when the effects of diet culture and body policing are especially prevalent for women. You know, we're right at the cusp of beach body and bikini body advertisements for summer. And to me, those always feel like such a blatant example of this social conditioning, you know, like, are all 7 billion inhabitants of the world really meant to want to look the same way? Apparently. but we're just so removed from the idea of subjectivity and preference and individuality. And I mean, do you feel like there are some main kind of culprits of this where we especially see this idea of aesthetic homogeneity, you know, really promoted?
Yeah, and I think, you know, once you get through the warmer weather, right, so we have more skin exposed. And so it's just like, oh my God, you know, your body's not good enough. It's got to be, you know, get into shape and do all these changes so that people can see more of you on display. You know, this kind of panic that they start in the advertising industry and all that. And I think it's this idea that a lot of, you know, Americans have that you can just sort of remake your body or remodel it as if it's like a house or something. But it's like this project that you can just kind of work on.
Yes.
So I think, you know, all of that kind of plays into it, you know, all these different things. But a lot of it is driven, I think, by people who have a financial interest, you know, making money off making women feel anxious about their bodies.
Yeah, I mean, the weight loss industry as a whole, that's kind of its job, is to make people feel bad.
Right, if people feel good about themselves, they don't make money. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's sort of one of the most terrifying but brilliant industries in the world, because it's, you know, it's run on the idea that you will fail and then you will turn back to the same exact industry for more help. It blows my mind. I find it really distressing.
Yeah, but there's this idea that we can achieve that, you know, and it's sad, but people believe it, and then when they don't achieve it, they blame themselves for it.
Yeah, and then... Yeah, actually, we have a segment on the show called Words Matter, where we discuss a lot of loaded or controversial terms within the umbrella of body or fat politics. So things like BBW or fat or curvy. But I'm almost wondering if we can talk a little bit about, it's like a catchphrase, the thin person within. And, you know, it's definitely something Plum experiences. It's something fat people are almost programmed to believe, that there's literally another human being inside your body, and once the layers of fat are shed, that human will be able to travel and work a dream job and have the epic romance and just live their lives. So what are your thoughts on this trope and the potential harm it can cause?
Well, I had a lot of fun with that in the novel. This idea of the split self, you know, there's you and then there's the idealized version of you that you assume you've been brainwashed into thinking is going to emerge one day.
Yes.
And so many people put their life on hold until that day comes, which, you know, often doesn't. But, you know, I think that we have this idea that there are no fat people, that everyone's thin, that that's the default person, and that people who are fat just are a thin person with extra weight. And so I think that's part of the reason this kind of thin, that there's this idea that there's a thin person inside every fat person, because there's like, well, there's no such thing as a fat person. There's just a thin person who gained weight, who could therefore lose that weight.
And they need to be saved.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and the whole weight loss industry is based on that idea that there's this other version, you know, waiting to be set free. And it's just such a toxic, you know, idea. And, you know, one of the things I write about in Dietland is trying to live in the moment and learning how to live for today and not this future time where everything might be perfect. And I think that that can be sort of traumatic to take that step and say, you know, for a fat person, for example, to say, I'm not ever going to be thin, probably, you know, I'm fat and this is me and that's it.
Yeah.
And that can be hard to face, but I think if you can face it, it can be very liberating.
Absolutely. I feel like that's getting rid of that trope is one of Plum's kind of biggest journeys through the book, and realizing that she doesn't have to not live while she's fat. You know, she doesn't have to wait for things to happen. And it is hard. I mean, I certainly remember having those thoughts as a teenager and a young adult and thinking, when I'm thin, I will travel. When I'm thin, I will get married. When I'm thin, I will lose my virginity. When I'm thin, it'll all be okay. And then we set people up for even more failure because things will never be perfect. That's just not the reality of the world. And I think to assume that things like pain and heartache will just disappear once you achieve a certain body type just feels really absurd.
Yeah, I do wonder about people who do lose lots of weight, you know, if they are disappointed, you know, or, you know, what if the reality measures up to what they thought it would be. Because I have read, you know, about women who had weight loss surgery who lost a ton of weight very quickly. And it was very difficult for them because people treated them differently and they got very upset by that. You know, they're like, I'm the same person, I just look different.
Yes.
So I think that if, you know, someone who's fat were to achieve their dream of becoming thin, that there could be a lot of the difficulties with that that they might not anticipate.
When I kind of started going on my own mental re-education journey with fat acceptance, I just started realizing, you know, it's, and Plum realizes it as well, that all the anger I had towards myself should really be redirected towards all the people who think it's just okay to just shame you and treat you subhuman for the way you look. I mean, how ridiculous is that as a concept when you write it down? But we're just so used to it, I think, that it can be hard to say, this is wrong, you know, and instead just blame yourself.
Yeah, I think it's hard. I think it's hard for women in general to feel entitled to be angry. But I think for fat women, there's this extra idea that, well, you're fat, it's all your fault, you know, you only have yourself to blame kind of thing. I think it's hard to get to that place where you can feel entitled to be angry, but I think that's very important, you know, step to take, as of course Plum you know, explores in the novel. She gets very angry.
Yeah, she does. Actually, you know, something she's urged to do by the group of empowering women she ends up meeting is to confront the people who shame her rather than just ignore them in silence. And obviously fat people in real life are taught to believe that they should shrink in every way. You know, they should be as small and as invisible and quiet as possible. So to take a stand against those people verbally feels really, really radical. And I love seeing Plum start to confront people who are staring or mocking her and, you know, just asking, what are you looking at? And eventually physically stomping someone down. But when it comes to the kind of real world experiences, how do you feel about confronting people, you know, who do fat shame and who do just think they're entitled to treat you in this way?
I think it's interesting. I think there's been some discussion about this in terms of like street harassment, right?
Yes.
Of anyone of any size, of whether to confront someone like that. And I do think you have to be very careful, right? Because it could be very dangerous.
Yes.
You're obviously not dealing with a nice person.
No.
But I have to say that I have confronted someone before, and I just sort of, like, it had enough, and I just confronted this, you know, fat shamer, the complete stranger, in the street, and he just, like, freaked out. He was, like, he didn't say anything. He started apologizing, and I do think that that would probably be a common reaction, because people don't expect fat people to talk back, they expect them to just absorb the shame. And if you do talk back, I think it very really unsettles people. And I've seen that. Of course, you have to be careful for the person who might attack you physically or something. But I think that the people who are bullies are often sort of insecure like that. They just want to pick on somebody they don't think will do anything back. And when they do, it's like, oh no.
What do I do now?
So I, for me, that was a really liberating experience. And so I do, I wish everyone could have an experience like that where they confront somebody and kind of get that sense of a satisfaction from it.
A big part, if not the entirety of Dietland, felt to me like a reclamation of so much, a reclamation of the female body, the fat body, things women are shamed for regardless of size. Not to give away too many spoilers to people who haven't read it, but Plum, comes into this world of really strong, empowered women doing greatly political work, and many of them are part of her ultimate transformation and her journey to self-love. And I'm kind of wondering what, again, the real world equivalent might be for people, and especially women, who are so tormented and ashamed over their bodies, but don't have this legion of badass feminist babes guiding them in the flesh. Is this where we turn to bloggers, to body image activists? Do we try to mold alternative media intake for ourselves? How do you even begin?
Yeah, one of the most heartbreaking responses I received to Dietland, and this has happened more than once, is somebody who's written to me saying, I want to live in this place where Plum goes to live in the novel, Calliope House, with all these women that you were just talking about. And they're like, I want to go live there. I want something that. And it's sad because it's hard to find, community, I think. I think, in the novel, Plum starts out very, very alone. And then she changes when she meets these other women. And I think it's essential to have a community of people supporting you. As I don't think that she would have changed if she hadn't met these other people. No. But I think it's hard. But I think that, the internet does offer that, at least. Because I think most of the, or all of the fat activists that I know are people I know through internet. I think one of the great things it does is that it can connect you with people from all different places. So it kind of can open up a community to people that maybe are in different countries or different states. And so I think that's a great place to look for it. I still think it's great to find in-person community too, though, yes. If you can. But sometimes the internet can be a tool to find that. You might not realize that there are some activists living near you, that you might want to meet in person.
Having other fat friends in real life who are, fat empowered personalities in her life is hugely valuable. I know in Dietland, Plum at one point is saying, she's never wanted a fat friend. She's never had one and she doesn't want one. And I think that's sort of common as well, especially when you're a bit younger and you don't want to stand out even more and you don't want to be associated with all the stigma. So I know I personally always gravitated towards thin friends as a kid and as a teenager for those reasons, but as an adult who's tried to be more open-minded to fat politics, to just the diversity of bodies, it's been so important to just have these empowered, feminist radical figures in my life whose bodies I can also relate to.
Yeah, I think that's just such an important step. And you're saying, Plum didn't want fat friends when she was younger. And I think it's part of it because she didn't want to stand out even more, right?
Yes.
So one fat person gets negative attention, but two together would get even more.
That's even more,
yeah.
I mean, it's unavoidable that you're going to be stared at and harassed.
And I think that, I just think a lot of fat people have so much internalized fat hatred. They don't really want to be around other fat people. I agree that it's just so important to have other friends who are fat, particularly ones that aren't, engaging in diet talk all the time, but are just, accept themselves and you can kind of have a break from, it's this person that understands what you go through. Because I don't think, even if you're, your thin friends, no matter how well-intentioned they are, they don't know what it's like. And I think it's important to have people who know what that experience is like.
That's true. Something that's happening now, I'll give it a little shout out. Plus size model Essie Golden is having her Golden Confidence pool parties. I think she's planning on doing it across the country. But these are basically parties mostly for fat women to come together and just be in a completely shame-free, diet-free environment. And I imagine such a pool party might seem a little bit wild if you've never come across, like, an empowered fat person and all of a sudden you're in a room with 70 fat people in low-rise bikinis eating, you know, unapologetically eating junk food, like, or whatever it is they want to be doing. But it's probably, like, a little flooring if you've never encountered a fat-positive fat person. But I think those events as well are hugely important, and I'm so glad that she's hopefully going to be doing them on a kind of national level.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Yeah.
I'm very excited. There's one in New York next month in June. So, yeah, I'm sure it's going to be great if you're in New York. I highly urge everyone to go. Something I also think is especially important when trying to find your place in all of this is kind of self-reflection and asking yourself the tough questions, asking yourself why fat is bad, why your voice is somehow less than somebody else's. And usually I think when we pose the questions in that way, there's not necessarily any logical reasons behind any of it. And I kind of wanted to highlight a quote I found of yours, not from your book, but from your blog post on the UK release of Dietland, if you don't mind me quoting you to you.
Sure.
You wrote, "If you're a woman or if you're a man from a marginalized group, never let anybody make you feel that you're too ambitious. Never let anyone make you feel that you're not entitled to be angry in your work or that your work is too political or that you need to use nicer language to express yourself. Never believe anyone when they tell you that your work needs to fit into a box. We need your voices. We need oppositional, defiant voices in art and literature. Break those rules of what literature is supposed to be. Question what makes the rules and who what they ultimately serve. After many years of struggle, it's been a thrill for me to connect with readers who needed my voice and who value my words." And I just think that whole paragraph is incredibly lovely and necessary, and it touches upon, you know, pushing boundaries and talking about the hard stuff. But doing that is hard. You know, it can be really hard. And I think it puts you at times, or makes you feel like you're in a vulnerable position. And I wonder if there's any practical advice we can give people when it comes to finding the courage to push those limits.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, this, you know, with my book, it was hard to find an agent to represent me. And I had to stick with it like 18 months. But I just had confidence that someone out there would take on this book and try and sell it. And I think it's hard. I think that it's, you know, if you're talking about publishing, for example, there are all these gatekeepers that can try and keep out these more radical voices. Yes. And that can happen, you know, in any area of life. And so I think it's, you know, I think to fight to make yourself heard. And I think that nowadays there are more outlets, you know, for spreading, you know, your own writing or whatever it is you do, your photography, your music, whatever way you express yourself. There are at least more outlets for that now, which I think is a good thing. But I think it's, you know, my most important advice, I guess, would just be to stick with it, because people are going to try and tear you down and stop you, and to just not give up and keep going, because there are people who want to hear these things and read these things. You have to find those people.
Are you able to talk a little bit about Dietland being commissioned for TV, or would you rather?
Yeah, I can a little, yeah.
Oh, that'd be great. So, yeah, I know, that's really all I know. I know that Dietland's, you know, commissioned for TV, but I'd love to know what that experience has been like so far. Anything you can share?
So it's an option for TV by Marty Noxon, who she worked on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and she was a writer for Mad Men, and she did the show Unreal that was on last year.
Yes.
And she's done lots of other things. But so she optioned it. There were a lot of people interested, actually, which surprised me. you know, because we don't ever see people are like Plum and, you know, movies and on TV, or very rarely.
Especially Plum, once she's in her, like, colorful tights and combat boots.
Exactly. You know, but what I learned is that there's a lot more outlets on TV now, you know, like Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and all these streaming outlets. And it's creating an opportunity for new, more diverse stories about women. And so I think Dietland's is part of that, you know, that this may not have even been possible like a year ago.
Is there anything you're worried about kind of translating the story to TV?
When people first began to approach me about it, the first thing that came into my mind was like Gwyneth Paltrow in a fat suit.
Yes. Shout out to Shallow Hell.
Yes. And Monica and Friends, and
yes,
you know, Fat Bastard, Austin Powers movies. So that was like my nightmare scenario.
Yes.
But, you know, I talked about that with everyone that was interested in it, and they were all, like, immediately, like, that would never happen. You don't have to
That's
worry.
Good. That's good to hear.
Yeah, so...
I think that would be the main fear. If I ever had written a book like this, and it was going to be on film or TV, it'd be who's going to be cast as these characters that are supposed to be different. You know, they're not supposed to be Gwyneth Paltrow in a fat suit. They're supposed to be an actual representation of a fat, empowered person.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, there aren't really a lot of fat actresses, right? Because they never get, I mean, not ones at least we see in films and TV, because they don't get the opportunity to be in anything. So it'll be really interesting to see who plays Plum. I don't know anything about that yet. But, you know, it's exciting that she will be, you know, really fat, not like Hollywood's version of fat, like Amy Schumer or something.
There's all that controversy now with celebrities like Amy Schumer and Lena Dunham being called plus size and all these, you know, just these women who are actually just below the average size, really, of the American woman, which is a size 14, 16. And yet anything above a size 4 is like fat or plus size in Hollywood, which is also very strange.
I know, like Hollywood and then also the fashion industry, you know, I used to work in women's magazines. They have a very skewed reality. And so they start judging people based on their warped sense of what people look like. So then we have, you know, yeah, Amy Schumer is plus size, but she's a size 6. But in their world, she is plus sized.
Yeah, I guess if your world is mostly consisting of people who are a size 2, then anything above that is going to be different.
Exactly. I mean, that's what they're comparing it to, you know, comparing people to.
Another little segment we like to do on the podcast is a shout out to what I like to call the body positive badass of the week. And this is typically a person who you feel is very inspirational, someone tackling issues of body image or fat acceptance or body pos, but who might not be getting the credit you think they deserve. And I'm wondering if there's anyone you'd like to put a spotlight on.
Well, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I don't know if that's okay.
It's okay.
I have a feeling most of the people I would highlight are people that you know already. But I wanted to talk about a book that's an anthology that has many different women's voices in it. And people who have really been into fat activism will probably know this book. But I bet most of your listeners won't. It's called Shadow on a Tightrope, Writings by Women on Fat Oppression. And it's from 1983, and it's edited by Lisa Schoenfielder. And it's actually out of print, but there are a lot of copies available online used. And this, I wanted to just highlight this because it's, you know, it's more than 30 years old. But I think it's a great example that the kind of fat activism that we're doing now has roots, you know, in...
it's not necessarily new.
Right, exactly. And I think if you read this book, you know, some parts of it would seem dated now, but, you know, there are essays that are just, they're really angry and they're radical and they're searing. And, you know, some of them are quite sad too, fat women talking about their lives. But I think it has, there's just so much to learn, I think, from activists that have come before and how they were addressing issues. And also it's a little bit depressing, I think, to see some of the issues that, well, unfortunately, we still have to deal with. But I just wanted to highlight something, I think, from an earlier generation of activists. I think it's important to acknowledge that we're part of a longer history.
Definitely. I mentioned this on the first podcast that we did, which was that even in the 60s, there was a fat inn in Central Park here in New York, where people who were fat positive got together in the park. And I think what they did was burn pictures of Twiggy while, you know, really unapologetically eating junk food and just anything that their hearts desired. And I mean, for the 60s, that's incredibly radical as well. This was way before body pos was a buzzword. So I definitely agree these things have roots, and acknowledging those roots and then being able to analyze how things have changed and how they haven't and how we can be doing more all comes naturally once you do.
Exactly, yeah. So I think that I kind of am attracted to that angrier writing. So I just wanted to highlight that Shadow on a Tightrope.
That's great.
We need to, you know, if we want people to think of fat and to accept fat, we need to show what it looks like to live that way, because to a lot of people it's unimaginable. So that's one thing I wanted to do with the novel. Fiction can do that, you know, it can show you what's possible, the kind of what if, you know, what if I stopped hating myself, what would that look like? We need to kind of imagine it before it can happen. You know, if something's unimaginable, I don't think it could happen.
That's very true. I think fiction can do that. books like Dietland can do that, where you're kind of left wondering, well, you know, why can't I do this too? Why can't I start living now? Why can't I be okay as I am? And asking yourself those questions and realizing that you actually can.
Exactly. Seeing other people, you know, and there's so many great people on social media that do that as well, you know, not just in books, but just to set that example. I think that's so important to see.
Thank you for putting a depiction like that out into the world, because like I said, it's definitely one of the first times I've seen it in fiction. Hopefully there will be more, but I think for a lot of people, Dietland has been and will continue to be just a very necessary stepping stone.
Oh, thank you.
Of course. I mean, thank you for being on the podcast and for your words, for your work. It's hugely inspirational. You know, I feel like I'm surrounded by fat acceptance literature a lot, but this just felt kind of just like it's had the potential to be relatable to both people in and outside that bubble. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, thank you. No, I really enjoyed chatting with you. It's been great.
Thank you. And, you know, if people want to find you, if they want to keep up to date with your work and the things you're doing, what's kind of the best way?
They go to my website. So Sarai, my first name is spelled Sarai Walker.com. And I have links to all my, you know, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram on there. So I'm all over the internet.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarai. That was awesome.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you guys so much for listening. This episode was produced by Sarah Barrett, with editorial oversight by Anna Parsons and music by Patty McClave. As always, you can find the podcast on our Rad Podcast Network, Acast, or subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes. If ever you have any questions or topics you'd love us to discuss, please email at thebodcast@bustle.com. Thanks again.